From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, the Israeli military launched a new wave of strikes on the Gaza Strip, the Palestinian territory governed by the group Hamas. Israel said it destroyed several miles of tunnels and homes of commanders of Hamas. The latest round of violence after last week's clash at a holy site revered by both Muslims and Jews. Palestinians say Israeli police provoked an incident there. Hamas then began firing rockets, which triggered these retaliatory Israeli strikes. CNN international diplomatic editor Nick Robertson is on Israel's border with Gaza. Nick, it's always more complicated than we can say in an introduction. We're going to have a closer look at the region elsewhere on the program. But what are you seeing?
What we're seeing today is the guns are speaking louder than the diplomats. We've been at the forward positions of Israeli Defense Force artillery. They've been loading their guns or putting behind their guns new artillery shells. They've been putting them out by the guns, and those guns have been firing off into Gaza. We've also seen and heard intercepts in the sky, Israel's Iron Dome, protecting Israeli citizens from the rockets that are being fired from Gaza by Hamas. That's been in action today. So the conflict here is definitely in a continuation mode, and diplomacy, it seems, is taking a back seat.
Well, how is Hamas responding?
Hamas has said that there have been talks, that they've been engaged with Egyptian officials. Qataris are involved as well. They have a condition on a cessation that Israel would stop what they describe as provocations in Jerusalem. And the other roadblock to an agreement is that Hamas says Israel is telling them that they must go on a ceasefire first for 3 hours before Israel will stop firing its weapons. And that, for that condition for them, is unacceptable. Now, we don't know Israel's position on these discussions. This is what a senior Hamas official has told us.
Well, and when you say Israel must stop its provocations in Jerusalem, again, this can get very nutty and detailed, but what exactly?
In the past few weeks leading up to the current hostilities, Israel was trying to evict four Palestinian families from a neighborhood of Jerusalem called Sheikh Jarrah. So the provocations, it appears, would involve Israel withdrawing the demand that these families should be evicted from the homes that they've been living in for several decades. And the other issue is, again, one of the contributing factors to this current round of violence, and that was the Israeli police going into the Al-Aqsa Mosque, Islam's third holiest site, during one of the holiest days of Ramadan as well. And Hamas clearly indicating, it seems, that that is one of the provocations that they want to stop.
Do we understand that the Israeli police cut the wires of a loudspeaker? That was the provocation, really, at the kind of the tipping point of this.
It was that incident at Al-Aqsa Mosque that triggered sort of that final piece of anger. Hamas, 3 days before that incident of the wire cutting, Hamas had issued a warning, if you will, to Israel to take its hand off Jerusalem, else there would be repercussions. And those repercussions came when Hamas fired a rocket at several rockets at Jerusalem on Jerusalem Day.
Just very briefly, Nick, all American presidents will say they respect the right of Israel to defend itself, for instance, from those incoming rockets. But people in the United States, some Democrats in particular, are calling on President Biden to respond more forcefully to Israel attacks. What are you hearing there?
At the moment, we're hearing very few details of how that's translating into a real change of events on the ground. I think if we look to the days after President Biden's statement there, his Eid al-Fitr message, and also the Eid al-Fitr message that was issued to Muslims at their holiest time, that's artillery rounds going off where we're located here, they both put the importance of civilian lives at the forefront. So I think there's an effort on the messaging here by the White House and the administration to show that they care about the Palestinian position. The way I think that Prime Minister Netanyahu is turning the phrasing, President Biden's phrasing around here, is to indicate that he essentially has more time to continue targeting elements of Hamas that clearly he and the Israeli government feel are necessary targets to prevent an extended period of hostilities, or Hamas again choosing a time and place for it to initiate an attack on Israel. That's the impression that's created at the moment.
Look, Nick Robertson, again, CNN's international diplomatic editor, we want you to go get safe. Nick, thank you.
Thank you.
Here in this country, advocates for affordable housing are facing an onslaught that few saw coming. Real estate companies that invested in affordable homes as part of a government program are now looking to cash in. An investigation by member station WBUR finds these companies are trying to squeeze big profits out of those properties. Lawmakers say these investors are subverting Congress's intent for the program, and they're looking for ways to stop them. WBUR's Beth Healy reports.
Charles Clark walks through Boston's South End, passing by multi-million dollar condos.
This is ours. And look how good we keep this building. This is why we're so proud.
It's a historic brownstone, one of many low-income buildings managed by a nonprofit called Tenants Development Corporation, or TDC. Clark landed one of these apartments back when he was a young musician, just starting out. Now he's president of the group's tenant-run board.
This will be my 40th year living here. TDC. A little bit of everybody lives in the South End. That's what makes it so unique.
But now TDC is in a pitched legal battle to hold on to these homes. The Denver investment firm Alden Torch Financial is trying to control the future of 36 buildings where the nonprofit's tenants live. It's a fight playing out in cities from Boston and New York to Miami and Seattle. Here's the history. Clark and his neighbors benefited from a program Congress designed to attract investors, like big banks, to help build or renovate low-income housing. The investors would partner with nonprofits in exchange for tax breaks called low-income housing tax credits.
After 15 years, a nonprofit typically gets the rights to the property back from the bank. And this is where the big problem now starts.
That's U.S. Senator Ron Wyden, a Democrat from Oregon who's chair of the Senate Finance Committee. He and housing specialists across the country say the system worked well for decades. The investor got 15 years of tax breaks, and the nonprofit, like TDC, would generally get to buy out the partnership at a low price and own the property. But a new breed of investors is changing the game.
Most recently, private equity firms, they're attracted to rising property values, swoop in, buy out the bank's limited partners, and then squeeze the hell out of a bunch of loopholes, tax loopholes, to extract all the gains in property value.
Lawsuits in multiple states show Alden Torch and others, like Wall Street giant AIG, American International Group, challenging the rights of nonprofits to take title to these properties. They're demanding cash payouts, waging costly court battles, and sometimes forcing the sale of low-income housing. In Boston, court records show Alden Torch told TDC to sell 36 of its buildings, then did a U-turn when it realized that triggered TDC's right to acquire them. Now it's suing to prevent TDC from buying the properties and alleging the nonprofit must have Alden Torch's consent to move forward. Charles Clark, the TDC board president, says it's painful for the group to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on legal bills instead of on programs for residents.
You know, greed is all around us, but we're not going to let that greed destroy what we worked so hard to build all these years.
There are some legal protections for the tenants. Even if a new owner took over the buildings, they'd have to stay affordable for at least 15 more years. But after that, things could change. Alden Torch executives declined to comment for this story. In a letter, the company says it's trying to maintain the status quo at the South End apartments. But it also claims investors have a right to benefit from the appreciation of property. Senator Wyden says that's just
a complete fabrication. It was Congress's intent that vulnerable people benefit, not private equity. How they've been able to twist this piece of legislation to say that it was somehow the intent of the Congress to cut a sweetheart arrangement for private equity? No way. Period. Full stop.
Wyden says he's working on legislation called the DASH Act, or Decent, Affordable, Safe Housing for All, that would include language to clarify the law and head off these disputes. In the meantime, there's no federal oversight of these imploding partnerships, even for an IRS program funded by $8 billion a year in taxpayer money. When these cases land in court, judges are serving up a slew of conflicting opinions. That's got housing officials in a handful of states raising red flags. Here's Sheila Dillon, Boston's housing chief.
The idea that limited partners are trying to, you know, force sales and make these properties no longer affordable is pretty despicable. Preserving all of our affordable housing in Boston is very important, but it's especially important in neighborhoods such as the South End, where property values have risen and there has been a significant amount of displacement.
New York's attorney general has weighed in on behalf of a Brooklyn housing group battling AIG, which declined to comment for this story. And Washington State's housing agency has launched new rules to crack down on what it calls investor schemes that do not serve the public. Alden Torch's response, it sued the agency and its commissioners. For Here and Now, I'm Beth Healy.
Today is the deadline to file federal tax returns, and chances are, if you're a white taxpayer, you're getting a better deal than black Americans. According to a new book called The Whiteness of Wealth, the U.S. tax system has long favored white people, and that has helped reinforce and create a staggering racial wealth gap. The author, Emory University tax law professor Dorothy Brown, joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You say here that you went into tax law to be in a career where race and racism had nothing to do with your work. It's so interesting. Why was that something you wanted to avoid?
Well, because I born and raised in the South Bronx, I dealt with racism all the time, and I didn't want to also deal with it in an area of law that I was going to work in. And as I say in the book, I've never been more wrong about anything in my life.
How did you realize that you were so wrong?
Well, I read an article by a mentor, and in the article he said, how do you know there isn't a race and tax issue if you don't look? So I thought, well, I'm going to look. And that was when I realized that the IRS does not publish statistics by race, which made my job much harder.
And that was a surprise? You didn't know that?
I had no idea because I didn't think tax had anything to do with race. I would joke that the only color that mattered was green. So once I started looking or connecting race and tax, all kinds of things that I never realized before became readily apparent.
Okay, well, give me one of those examples. What's the clearest example that you can find that explains how tax policies put black people at a disadvantage?
Well, I can think about marriage. Most Americans that get married get a tax cut. But there's a significant minority of Americans when they get married, they pay higher taxes. Well, as it turns out, if you look at Census Bureau data, which actually does provide this information by race, you see white married couples are more likely to contribute income, and I'll explain that in a minute, that leads to them getting a tax cut. But black married couples are more likely to contribute income to the household in a way that leads to higher taxes.
Okay, tell us why that is.
Let's say someone makes $50,000. As a single person, their taxes are going to be a certain rate. But as a married person with a single wage earner, that $50,000 household is going to wind up paying less taxes than that single wage earner had they remained single.
It's usually the man, right?
Yeah, right.
Who would have the big job, who would earn the most amount of money in the family? Maybe the wife would take care of the family and not have an income.
Right.
That's what you're talking about here?
That's exactly what I'm talking about. And looking at Census Bureau data makes it really clear that that family is more likely to be white than black.
Huh.
On the other hand, the couple where both spouses are working full time and contributing roughly equal amounts to household income, they don't get a tax cut. That couple is more likely to be black than white.
And that couple was your parents.
That couple was my parents. So I'm doing as any good daughter with an LLM in tax, right? Does her parents' tax returns. And I'm seeing something's wrong. I'm doing my taxes and I made by myself roughly what my parents made combined. But my parents, I wasn't paying that much more. I was paying more, but not that much more. And I always came away from doing our returns thinking something's wrong and I can't figure it out. And this went on and on until I became a professor and started looking at race and tax. And the very first thing I wrote about was the marriage penalty and the marriage bonus. And it explained why my parents were paying so much in taxes. It was because their incomes were very close together.
And help me understand why you're more likely to see that in a black family like yours versus a white family.
Well, when we look at the labor market, higher wages are received by white male workers than virtually every other category. So it takes more workers to equal what a white worker can get.
In your book, you make the point that this discrimination is found across the board, from housing to employment,
right,
to education to marriage, which we just talked about. And you also say that many of the tax laws were made at a time when black families were paying into the system, but they didn't have the same legal rights to housing, to employment, to education, and to marriage. What is the consequence
exactly
of
right.
that?
Well, the consequences, black taxpayers are paying for our own subordination. And I'm thinking of what happened after World War II, where the income tax system was transformed. It went from only the richest Americans pay it to most Americans paying it. And that happened in the 40s, when we still had Jim Crow, when the FHA would not insure mortgages for homes in black neighborhoods. So we had taxpayer dollars funding HUD, but HUD's policies and programs discriminated against black Americans.
Do you think that the tax policies were made with explicit racist intent?
You know, I think the tax policies were made with the intent to benefit white Americans. And a lot of the tax policies I talk about in the book are traced back to this Jim Crow era. And if you are a legislator and you think that blacks are second-class citizens, and the law tells you black Americans are second-class citizens, then making tax law to benefit white Americans seems very normal and very natural.
What do you think is keeping us from creating a more equitable tax system now?
Well, Treasury not publishing statistics by race is the biggest problem. We have the president's executive order that talks about racial equity across government agencies, including Treasury, but I'm seeing nothing out of Treasury that would give me hope that this is going to turn around.
Well, speaking of the president, he has come out with a plan to change capital gains taxes. This is something that you write about in the book. And that means that if you sell an investment, you're going to pay capital gains on the amount of money that you make off of that. This is how rich people get richer, the saying goes, because it's taxed at a lower rate than you would pay for normal wages, right? President Biden
exactly.
says he wants to change the capital gains tax, raising the top rate above 43%. It would be the highest in modern times. Is this the sort of policy that would help the racial discrepancies that you write about?
Absolutely, because when we look at ownership of stock, there are huge racial disparities, and it goes across income lines. So you could say, well, that's just because blacks are disproportionately poor, and it's really not a race issue, Dorothy, it's a class issue. But if you look at high-income black Americans, if you look at wealthy black Americans, we don't own stock to the extent that our white peers do. So increasing taxation on this very racialized asset, stock, right, would make a big difference in racial equity concerns. Because you see black Americans are disproportionately, we receive wages, right, and we are taxed on our wages at the maximum progressive tax rate. So what this would do would, for people with income over $1 million, would require income from stock to be taxed at the same tax system as income from wages.
So what is your advice to black taxpayers who have to work inside this system? What should they do?
That's such a great question. And I talk about being a defensive player. So if you're going to get married, don't get married on New Year's Eve, get married on New Year's Day. That delays the issue 1 year.
Really?
Right? Something simple. If you're thinking about buying a home because of the different returns on homeownership to black homeowners versus white homeowners, then think about it. Do you want to be one of the few black homeowners in an all-white neighborhood, which would make it a good financial investment, but you will have to deal with racism of neighbors, perhaps calling the police on you when you're trying to get in your own home? On the other hand, you could buy in a racially diverse or all-black neighborhood, recognizing you won't get out of the home as much as if you lived in an all-white neighborhood. So you don't put all of your money in a home. You make sure you max out on your retirement account. You make sure you set up a child savings account for your child to go to college. So you basically become proactive, recognizing that the system isn't designed for black wealth.
Reading this book forced a little bit of putting a mirror in front of my own face. You know, people like me, I wonder what you say to them. I went to an elite school, two of them, graduated without debt. My parents paid for it, right? I own a home that helps me accumulate wealth. I have investments in the stock market. I contribute fully to my employer's retirement plan.
Right.
What do you say to people like that, like me?
I'd say, I'm glad you're telling your story, Peter, right? And I want more white Americans to tell their story, right? I want more white Americans to say, I didn't have a college debt problem the way black Americans do because I had family wealth that paid for my college. I had down payment assistance, or because I didn't have debt, I could save money for a down payment. Part of what I'm asking white Americans to do is to tell their stories of intergenerational wealth and how it's not that black Americans aren't working hard enough, aren't saving enough. It's that the wealth building system is inherently stacked in favor of white wealth building.
Dorothy Brown's new book is The Whiteness of Wealth. She's a law professor at Emory University. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Good question.
That's a really good question.
It's a great question.
This is free therapy.
Thank you for asking me that.
God, that's such a good question.
That's an interesting question.
But what Fresh Air interviews are really about are the interesting answers. Listen and subscribe to Fresh Air from WHYY and NPR.
AT&T and Discovery are sending shockwaves through the media landscape today, announcing that AT&T's WarnerMedia will combine with Discovery to create a new entertainment company with some of the biggest media brands, CNN, HBO, TBS, and, of course, Discovery. Two big streaming services will also be a part of this new company, so what does it mean? Let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, CBS News analyst, host of Jill on Money. Jill, AT&T was in the content business. Now it's spinning off these brands. Why is it doing this?
I think this is a really big acknowledgement from AT&T, which says this. We thought we were this huge content provider. We owned the pipes through which content flows. So we thought it would be really smart to own not just the pipes, but the stuff that moves through the pipes. As a result, sort of 2015-ish, they started with an acquisition of DirecTV. They then went and bought WarnerMedia for more than $80 billion. And now they are saying, these are different businesses. We need to shed these assets and really concentrate on our core business. So I think the most important part of this is an acknowledgement that telecom companies cannot necessarily get into the content business so easily.
Okay. And so companies, you know, that they're buying through Discovery can tell us, remind us who they are.
Okay. So let's talk about these two big companies. So WarnerMedia has a studio, but it also has some cable networks like CNN and TNT. And as you said, they have some streaming content as well. And when you look at the other side, Discovery, you've got Oprah Winfrey's own network. You've got the Food Network and Animal Planet. The idea here, I think, is that you bring these content providers together. You get sort of a news, sports, entertainment company pushing it out on the streaming platforms while we're still collecting the money we can using cable. And that's a smarter combination than saying a telecom provider and a content company.
Yeah. Is it also about having an eye on the future and maybe cable won't be the thing providing revenue? I mean, there's been some slippage on cable and satellite viewing. Is this kind of preparing for streaming being the only thing?
Absolutely. I think that when you look at both of these companies, they are trying to turn these legacy cable brands, but acknowledging that the content that those cable brands bring may be better for streaming platforms.
Right. And what does it mean to me, the viewer who likes to not know about any of this and just watch?
I think from a viewer perspective, we are now in our own transition period. A lot of people signed up for streaming services amid the pandemic. Now things are opening up. Now, do I really want to be paying 15, 18, 10, 9, whatever the numbers are? And at some point, we're sort of in our old problem, which is the cable bundle. Like, why am I paying so much for all this stuff that I don't necessarily watch? It doesn't really matter what you're comparing. The question really is, how will our behavior change? We know from recent earnings reports that new subscriptions to services like Netflix and Disney have slowed down some. That slowdown could portend something changing in the streaming wars.
And we know that we have changed. I mean, some of us remember sitting down and watching three channels on our TV set, and that was it. So it's a constantly evolving thing. Jill Schlesinger, CBS News analyst, host of Jill on Money, thank you.
Great to be with you.
So what did the new CDC guidelines on wearing masks mean for the restaurant industry? Well, it depends on who you ask. The CDC announced last week that fully vaccinated people no longer have to wear masks unless there are people falling all over them, say at a parade. The National Restaurant Association, which had been for a full mask requirement, says the CDC decision means it's now up to individual restaurants whether they want to keep it for fully vaccinated people. And today, we were all set to talk to James Beard award-winning food writer Corby Kummer, who is also director of the Aspen Institute's Food and Society Program, which recently put out a comprehensive report on safety in the industry with an A-list including Chef Jose Andres, the James Beard Foundation, that aforementioned National Restaurant Association. So, Corby, you there?
I'm here. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you? I'm sure it was a weekend filled with phone calls because part of your report, it's called Safety First, Protecting Workers and Diners as Restaurants Reopen, includes a pledge from diners, and number one on that list, wear a mask at all times except when eating. Now, the Restaurant Association is your partner in all of this, and they announced over the weekend they're going to leave it up to restaurants. So are you softening your position as well, you know, pulling back from that masks for everyone pledge?
Absolutely not. And, you know, I talked to my working partners, the most wonderful guy, Larry Lynch, at the Restaurant Association just this morning. It's up to businesses to decide how can we best protect our workers and our guests. And it's also up to the localities that are saying we still have a mask mandate. We don't have a mask mandate. You have to, as a small business owner, stay in the restrictions of your local health department. Those aren't all changing. And so restaurants, I spoke with Jose Andres's team. I've spoken with all of our working partners in Safety First. And everybody's feeling just the same. Until CDC or the federal government gives us a nationally verifiable way of being able to be sure that people who say they are fully vaccinated really are fully vaccinated, we're going to ask everybody to keep their masks on, especially workers in small kitchens.
Well, because you say that restaurants, I mean, what this has done is put restaurants in the position of being the vaccine police.
And nobody can be the vaccine police because there's nothing enforceable as far as an actual app. So different countries like Israel, the state of New York has contracted with IBM. It's Excelsior, an Excelsior app in which the state of New York is giving information on who has been vaccinated, providing it to this app so you, the consumer, can sign up for that app. And then the restaurant, if it chooses, can say, hey, could you show us your Excelsior checkmark, both when you're making a reservation and when you're coming into the restaurants? That's state by state. There is no federal registry. It doesn't exist yet. There's going to be terrific resistance to having a federal registry. So for now, restaurants can't be in the business of saying, hey, honor pledge, you want to raise your hand again? Are you really vaccinated?
Right. Well, and so you are keeping, as part of this huge, very detailed report, the number one pledge from a diner, I will wear a mask so that my wait staff doesn't have to wonder whether or not, doesn't have to ask me. It's also safety, because we still don't know. There can be tiny transmission. But number two on this diner's code of conduct is be kind. We were already hearing about waitstaff completely exhausted from people who didn't want to wear masks and having to fight with them back when it was a full-blown requirement across the board in restaurants. Isn't that only going to get worse when people come in and say, hey, the president says I don't have to wear a mask. The restaurant association said, you know, it's up to the restaurant. I feel that I don't have to wear a mask. Isn't it going to get worse if it's not across the board?
I completely agree. There is going to be more attention with restaurants. So we went out to eat both Saturday and Sunday night to see what it was like for restaurants after these guidelines. And boy, was everybody in a mask, especially the workers and the servers. So our partners at One Fair Wage, which advocates for equal salary and equal treatment for all restaurant workers, had given us a wonderful script for our safety first guidelines that strongly suggested that the host or anyone who seats the party of diners says, hey, could you put your mask on when the server comes and when you get up? So that there was no conflict between the actual server of the table, no endangering of a tip, so there could be a wonderful, warm relationship. I think that what's going to happen now is the restaurant will set an example by saying, hey, all of our workers are continuing to wear masks. And one of Jose Andres's key insights as we were preparing these guidelines are there are no first and second class citizens if you've been vaccinated or unvaccinated. And now, with the new guidelines, it could make, for example, somebody who is immunocompromised and ineligible to get the vaccine but still wants to work at a restaurant will suddenly be stigmatized by wearing a mask as a server. And so it's just a case of equality and equity to make sure that all workers are wearing masks in what could still be a risky environment, a small indoor space with a lot of people without masks, which is why we spend so much time on ventilation in our new guidelines.
I want to talk about the ventilation because this report isn't just some random guide. There's pages and pages for every part of the restaurant, front of the house, back of the house, kitchen, things like assigning a workplace COVID coordinator, organizing workers into teams who work on alternate shifts and days, limiting certain areas to workers only, again, protect the workers, no deliveries, no visitors to those areas. But also the scientific findings, the latest on droplets, ventilation, transmission. Talk a little bit about the information for the restaurants.
You know, what's so interesting is we spent months and months with weekly meetings. What's changing in the news about ventilation, about droplet transmission, aerosol transmission? What was constantly changing was the de-emphasis on surface sanitation. It sure is important for food safety. It will always be urgent for anybody handling your food to be super careful to wash her or his hands, including with gloves on, which are no magic cure. People get very lazy about washing hands when they have gloves on. That's different from COVID transmission. COVID transmission is aerosols and air. That will continue to be a problem, especially around bars. And I have to say what the servers in the restaurants we went to this weekend were most concerned about was bars and what the behavior is going to be like in bars as people have more alcohol, they're chatting, they're talking in loud voices. So
What could go wrong? I just want to get you to be specific here because you say not every restaurant can do an upgraded or new HVAC system, But they can do things like open windows, doors, switch the direction of ceiling fans.
I would love to be specific about this, because what we challenged ourselves to do was come up with some simple common sense steps that small businesses who have no money can't possibly change their HVAC systems can do. So if you have a ceiling fan, vent it upward, because the very best and safest kind of ventilation is floor to ceiling, not blowing back air onto diners and not especially blowing it across diners. The way most dining room and, you know, your home air conditioner, often air intake vents are on the wall. If there are tables near a wall intake vent, move the table or buy a plexiglass barrier that will divert the air from that. Kitchen ventilation, sort of ironically, is much safer for this because it's generally stove exhaust fans that vent straight up. So if anything that gets you straight up is best. Portable air purifying units they used to cost $75. Post-pandemic, there's been lots of inflation. They're $150, but they're still very affordable. If you can buy a bunch of these floor units that have HEPA filters, don't need any fancy gizmos like ultraviolet, germ irradiation, special filters, just HEPA. If you've got them on the floor, make sure that they vent upward the way all these units can be. They come vented sideways. You want it upward.
Okay, Corby Comer, award-winning, James Beard award-winning food writer, director of the Aspen Institute's Food and Society Program, and they have this intense, like, 75-page report. We'll link you up at hearenow.org. But for now, Corby,
user-friendly.
Wear your mask when you go to a restaurant for the person who maybe can't get a shot, and just to not make them be the police of you. Corby Comer, thank you so much.
Delightful, Robin.
For this next story about birds, we're reconnecting with a marine biologist named Hugh Griffiths. I first spoke with Hugh back in February after he and his team discovered sponge-like animals living on rocks far beneath the ice shelf in Antarctica. Well, it turns out Hugh is also a bird lover and a fantastic photographer. He's converted a window bird feeder at his home in Cambridge, England, into a photo studio. We're obsessed with it. And so, Hugh Griffiths, welcome back to Here and Now.
Hi, nice to be back. How you doing?
Yeah, doing well, thanks. And I did not expect, if we had you back on the show, to be talking to you about this. how did you come up with this idea to photograph birds through your window?
If you're a sort of person who gets to go outside a lot, like I do with my work, and to get on long trips and to see lots of amazing wildlife, being trapped in a semi-detached house in Cambridge is a bit of a shock to the system. So after a few months of lockdown, I really started to be a bit more creative about the wildlife I was getting a chance to see. So instead of being something in South America that I've trekked for days to see, I'm making the most of what I've got in the garden.
All right. So this is clearly a pandemic hobby. Walk us through your setup. How do you attract these birds to your window?
It all started when I got a bird feeder, and we've had bird feeders in the garden before, and we have some pretty badly behaved squirrels, grey squirrels that have sort of taken over the UK. And so we decided to get one that we could put on this large glass door that we have. And once we put a feeder on the window, we had a way of watching the birds feeding. So it was a really nice thing to be able to see that to begin with. And then I thought, well, actually, I could probably attach my phone to the window and start getting some really cool images.
So you're using your phone. That's unbelievable, because the images are so clear. The pictures, the video, all of it. And that's just with your phone?
Yeah, that's the amazing thing about this, isn't it? Something that pretty much anybody could do with only spending, you know, a few dollars on getting one of these plastic bird feeders with suction cups on it. And it's really low tech. I started off by just simply getting adhesive tape and taping my phone against the window and then just leaving the high quality video running. But then I started to play with the settings on the phone, and you know how you can kind of hold down on the screen to make it focus, and putting one hand out the window and actually putting my fingers where the birds would be when feeding so that I could focus just on that rather than working on the autofocus. From there, it's just playing with it and trying different types of food and different positions for the camera. And it's amazing how good a subject these birds are because they just keep coming back.
I want to talk to you about some of the images that you did capture here. But first of all, do you step away from the camera then so that they can't see you in front of the glass or behind the glass?
Yeah, for a lot of the species, the more nervous ones, you have to kind of, I go and do my work. I can leave it running for 20 minutes recording. And I see them coming and going from a distance, but I don't go near. But the robins, the little red-breasted European robins, they don't care about me. I got glared at by one yesterday when I was putting the food out a bit late in the morning. So some species really don't care. And other species took a while to get used to where the food was, let alone the camera and things.
Hugh, you make a really good point because with the robin glaring at you, the thing I'm most intrigued by is the drama that is, you know, captured in your own little backyard in Cambridge. I love the slow motion video of a robin that's coming in for a landing. There is the blue tit in a robin in a fight right in front of your window that you captured on camera. I mean, what are some of the moments that surprised you the most?
I've seen kind of three or four way fights for the food between starlings, sparrows, and different types of tits. And then you have this kind of invasion of this jay, a Eurasian jay, which is about 5 times bigger than the rest of the birds. And it comes along and just swallows most of the food whole and takes it away to bury. And so you get these kind of domestic fights between animals of the same species. Then other ones where they're not afraid to just fly at the other bird and kick them in the head to knock them off the food and stuff. And then you have stupid birds like the collared doves and types of pigeons, which will land on top of the feeder but not realize the food is underneath them. And they just look blankly at me through the window as if to say, where's all this food that all the other birds are getting?
We're going to link people to your work at hereandnow.org. Before I let you go, though, I got to ask you, you know, you're a marine biologist. Most of the time you're sort of working with animals underneath the water. You obviously have an interest in the natural world, but what have you learned about birds through watching them during the pandemic and taking images of them so closely? I mean, what sort of revelations have you had?
I don't know if there's any revelations, but I definitely think that thing about birds just being avian dinosaurs really comes to life when you see them up close and you get close-ups and slow motions of their movements, and it's all a bit Jurassic Park for my liking.
Hugh Griffiths is a marine biologist who takes just incredible photographs and videos of birds in his backyard through a window bird feeder. We're going to show you how to do it at hereandnow.org and link you to some of Hugh's pictures on his Twitter feed and his videos. Thank you so much, Hugh, for walking us through this. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And Robin, I got to give credit where it's due. That story was inspired by your recent piece about the bird calls of spring, which got us all riled up about birds. So thank you for that. Was that you? Are you doing that?
Yeah, it's my cardinal.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WVUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.